Okay, we are live. Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On today's show, I have a very special guest. His name is James Day. Last name is spelled D-A-Y, and he just published a book in November 2023. Title of the book is The Mad Bishops, The Hunt for Earl Anglin James and His Assassin Brethren. And it ties into the JFK assassination. I've done shows on William Joseph Bryan Jr., who is in this book, who's also one of these members of these kind of strange orders that kind of, I guess, branched off or are not recognized by the conventional Roman Catholic Church, but that are out there. And they're all, these guys are all over the JFK assassination and kind of, in a strange way, the United States kind of religious landscape in an odd way. But I've never heard the name Earl Anglin James. We're going to learn more about him. This is not James Day's first book. He's also written St. Michael the Archangel. Another is Michelangelo and the Sistine Chapel. I've been to the Sistine Chapel, great place. And A Place for Christ Forever, Becoming Christ's Cathedral. But again, we're going to talk about this book, The Mad Bishops. So James Day, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, William.
Excellent. So for people who may not have heard of your earlier books, can you maybe talk about your background and what led you up to putting this book together, The Mad Bishops?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I come from a Catholic Jesuit background, education background, and I've worked in higher ed and Catholic nonprofit media. So that sort of was the framework for getting published, getting those first books off the ground. As you mentioned, you know, writing about the popes, writing about Michelangelo, writing about angels and theology. So it really helped formulate research and, reaching out to various libraries and things that would come in handy working on this book on JFK. But, you know, specifically, I would continue on. I would say that this the Catholic milieu continues on in this work. You know, of course, JFK being the first Catholic president. But what really gravitated me to wanting to pursue JFK, William, was the infamous David Ferry. Who are you familiar with him?
Very much so. I've actually been doing a lot of research on Ferry. And in your book, you note that Jim Garrison said something very curious, which is David Ferry is one of the most important people that ever lived. It's a very curious statement, but what have you learned about him?
You know, David Ferry, exactly. So, you know, if we look, a good kind of starting point for Ferry is, of course, Oliver Stone's JFK. And, of course, Joe Pesci, you know, has that memorable role playing him out. Who was Ferry? Well, broadly, he was, you know, he was Oswald's mentor in the Civil Air Patrol. He was his captain when Oswald was a cadet. This was in New Orleans in the mid-50s. From there, there's been, after the assassination, Jack Martin, who is one of these kind of fake wandering bishops we'll talk about, made the accusation that it was Ferry who taught Oswald how to shoot with a telescopic sight, that he was in on the assassination, and that Ferry was from another wandering fake bishop, Raymond Brochures. We hear that Ferry was supposed to fly. There he is right there. There he was supposed to fly Oswald out of Texas to some safe house or something like that, which is why supposedly Ferry made that very mysterious trip to Texas the night of the assassination.
Right. And Martin, who was also affiliated with these other alternate old Catholic bishops or whatever, he told Garrison, I think on the 25th, so 2 or 3 days after JFK's dead, that Ferry was involved. So Ferry was on their radar right away. And it wasn't until the arrest and prosecution of Shaw, sure, that Ferry kind of came back into the news, right?
Right. And curiously, right when that case, when the Garrison investigation went public in early 67, Ferry, there's that kind of infamous line where, you know, he says, do you know what this means for me? You know, I'm a dead man, you know, meaning, you know, the word is getting out now. And I'm a marked man. And sure enough, you know, actually, we just passed his anniversary of his death just happened in 1967. Wow. And he was found dead, you know, still unconfirmed. It does look like it was maybe a natural death. I mean, I don't think he was murdered or suicided, but something happened to him right before the investigation took off. For me, it was personal in the sense that Ferry is from the same hometown I was born in Cleveland, Ohio. Ferry was as well. He came from a line of public servants, Cleveland Fire, Cleveland Police Department. Same as for me too. We both went to the same Jesuit high school called St. Ignatius. And we both went on to the same undergrad outside Cleveland called John Carroll. And so I'm seeing this and I'm like, wow, could this be the key? Could the key to the assassination really come from, you know, from my own backyard? And following Ferry's path, William, kind of brought me into this whole milieu of just this odd landscape of the Kennedy assassination.
Right. And it is interesting too, because Garrison was very much involved in the story of the old Catholic Church, and it was kind of left out of the JFK film that a lot of people use as a kind of reference point. But maybe you can talk about the real Roman Catholic Church, how important it is for a proper succession, and why this kind of alternate to the real Roman Catholic Church, why this alternate kind of these alternate systems kind of ventured out of the standard Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah, that's good. That's very astute, because it is important. It sounds like it's not important, but it is. And Garrison sensed that it was. I submit he didn't quite nail that aspect of the case. And by then, the Shaw case itself was kind of, you know, spiraling out of control. He was losing good key witnesses, et cetera. But nonetheless, he laid a lot of groundwork with investigating these fringe micro churches. As we might know, you know, we go back to St. Peter, traditionally is considered the first pope now, right? So today we have Pope Francis. He's been around since 2013 as Pope Francis. There's been 200 traditionally accepted line of Roman popes. There's been about 265 of them from St. Peter to today.
And Christ, really. So it goes back to Christ, where Christ says to Peter, after Peter realizes biblical or New Testament, he says, you are the Messiah. And then Christ says to Peter, and I can't remember exactly what it is, but I will make you the foundation of my church. Right. So that's the validity of the Roman Catholic apostolic succession back to Peter, right?
That's right. And so a pope is a bishop, meaning, you know, he's the shepherd of a certain flock of faithful. And, you know, the pope is the shepherd of the universal church. And so if one can only be made a bishop by other bishops, because they can say, well, we come from that initial line, starting with St. Peter and through the first 12 apostles, through the first fathers of the church, et cetera, down the line, we come from this kind of sacred line of sacred ordination. So we have this very special, gift that's been given to us from the beginning of the church. So over time, and we know, you know, for example, the Reformation and the splitting of the church, first with Orthodoxy back in the East with 1054.
Great Schism, yeah, 1054, that's right.
1054, and then the Reformation with, you know, Luther and the other Protestant churches that formed out of that. But what a lot of people don't know is that around 1700 or so, and really in the 19th century, when Vatican I convened, meaning the Vatican Council, the first Vatican Council met in 1870. And the thing that came out of that was the definition of papal infallibility, which we've all heard of, but it can get confusing what that exactly means. But there were groups that said, we can't accept that. But we still love the church. I mean, we just can't accept the Pope being infallible. So there are now factions that have grown out of this discord, mostly under the umbrella of what's called the Old Catholic Church. It's not referring to one building that's the Old Catholic Church. It's the an order, a group, basically functioning churches that consider itself to still be in communion with Rome, although Rome does not accept them as valid. So these groups create their own bishops, they create their own hierarchy, they create their own kind of theology. I mean, it's in line with Catholic Christianity, but it's its own thing. So a lot of these churches there are formed in the way Protestant churches are kind of formed today, where it's based on the pastor. So you have one person making another person bishop. This person says, I'm going to make my own church. He goes off and makes his own church. He makes his own bishops. Then those bishops makes their own church, etc. Why is this important? Well, in the JFK case, the case is just, as you mentioned at the top, is just riddled with these individuals who found sanctuary within this milieu of old Catholic micro church, fringe churches, and what's called wandering bishops. We can dig more into that, but do you want to?
Well, it's interesting because it's such an important part of all these guys, even William Joseph Bryan too. But they, for people who are within the Catholic group, it's so important to be ordained because that gives you all of the rights and powers of the priesthood, right? So correct. If you're not ordained, you don't have access to raising money, making other bishops, marrying, baptizing, right. Mass, which is crucial, right?
Right, right. And this was all very important to David Ferry because yeah. David Ferry wanted to be a legitimately recognized priest of the Roman Catholic Church. And he was in seminary, two different seminaries in the 40s. And he just, he couldn't, for his personality just did not mesh with the demands of, for whatever reason. He was gay. I mean, did that have a part to play? Possibly. That he just couldn't reconcile that with what the demands of the church, etc. So he was very interested in the idea of ritual and theology. But not all these guys were, though. And I think it's important to say that this was really a collection, for our purposes of these studying the assassination, this was a collection of con artists and charlatans who found within this milieu a way to kind of do some stuff hidden, kind of hiding in plain sight, because they would put on their Roman collar or they would put on those vestments. And back in the 50s, 60s, that was a kind of time when there was a deference to clerics right. in public, right? Kind of opening, right. Oh, Father, please go ahead.
Father,
sister.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, sister. Oh, yeah. Well, go ahead. Oh, your eminence, please. You first, you know, that kind of right. thing. So these guys saw that. And it was a very astute thing for them to see, because they saw, they, even though they probably had no degree whatsoever, they were able through, and this is where Earl England James came in. He was kind of a puppet master up in Toronto, who, if you wanted a diploma and if you wanted to be part of a chivalric order, that's with a fancy name, like, you know, the Greek Order of St. Denis of Zante, for instance, or if you wanted to be a clergy member, you would go to Earl England James, either through your networks or to James directly, and he would give you those documents for a fee. And that's how we know Ferry made a number of phone calls to Earl England James, which is what put Earl England James on Garrison's radar, kind of figuring out, well, what does this guy know? Et cetera. But
it just shows what these guys were in. These guys were in not a traditional thing, and the whole story about Ferry, I've heard it explained that they said in these two different places where he was studying, he had emotional problems, but that was a euphemism for his homosexuality. And I think that he preferred boys. So I don't know what you call that, but he seemed to have like a compulsion to be around young boys, and it ended up in the civil air patrol. Sure. Is that right?
Yeah.
And stuff.
Yeah.
Like that. So he's around.
Yeah. And we know he had a problem with that. We know he lost his job as a pilot because of infractions against young men. And so when you look at a 16-year-old Lee Oswald being part of this milieu under Ferry and the Civil Air Patrol, you can kind of see that there was a kind of charisma that Ferry kind of had. And he also was dabbled in hypnotism. So there was this, and he would do tricks, you know, like at Civil Air Patrol meetings, like he would hypnotize, you know, somebody, so there was this magnetism to him that was very attractive to a certain type of young man. And it just goes to show, I mean, David Ferry went to an all boys Catholic high school, you know, so I think right. there was that ingrained in him in the beginning. I do just want to make one point. Go ahead, William.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to say, I'm putting up this picture
yeah.
to show Ferry around these kind of young men. This was discovered after, long after the assassination. But right. Ferry's second from the left in That's the right. helmet.
Yeah.
And on the far right is a young 15-year-old Oswald.
Yeah.
So he's around a young Lee Harvey Oswald, I believe, in Louisiana. Oswald's from Louisiana.
Yes.
And Ferry is kind of in, if you look at this, he's kind of in a curiously close position to this guy bending over doing some, making food or something. It's a little bit unnerving. Yeah.
Yeah. This was a damning photo when that came out because, Ferry denied ever knowing or hearing of Oswald when the assassination happened. So obviously that wasn't the case. And one could even make the claim, you know, speculation, but one can make the claim that anything Ferry did, anything that Oswald did was with the approval of David Ferry. One can make that argument, including speaking at the Jesuit school of, to the Jesuit novices of Spring Hill, where Oswald's, I think his cousin was studying to be a Jesuit there. Oswald went to speak on his experiences in Russia. So
in 63, right? In 63.
I think it was July of 63. Yeah.
So it's before that. It's really incredible that how their lives intertwined. It's very, and I think you said brochures said that Ferry loved Oswald, which can connote other things. Like people haven't taken out of the, there's a potential that they were more than friends. I guess is the way to put it.
Yeah, and exactly. There's a lot of implication there, but I tend to sort of be careful on that by just going off of what basically what ultimately is hearsay and try to stick to the evidence. Although I will say the Civil Air Patrol plays a huge part in what I think is the assassination. There's Ferry there.
But this is the write-up. This is really fascinating. This is from his FBI file. This is dated.
Yeah.
3 days after the assassination. So Herman Kohaus, I guess, was the assistant district attorney who reached out to Ferry right there at the behest, I think, of Martin, who was also a traveling bishop with weird, you know, personal ties.
Right. Yeah. And it actually does mention right there having any information about Oswald's being in the Civil Air Patrol. So that was already on there. Yeah. Right. Or immediately afterwards. And I want to point out about the Civil Air Patrol. So the Civil Air Patrol shows up at various points. And a lot of this I found out after the book came out. And so I kind of want to share with you, if you start in New Orleans, you have Oswald and Ferry, as we've mentioned, at that particular unit. You go to the Texas School Book Depository that was owned by D.H. Byrd, who was instrumental, very instrumental in the founding of the Civil Air Patrol. And he was the wing commander of Texas. And so very important figure, very high up there. Wow. Okay. Then this has just recently been found. William, I'm going to say, I don't think anybody knows this. I did an article for it recently on Medium. And I think I'm the first to find this out. So, if you remember the whole J.D. Tippett scenario.
Yes.
Less than an hour after the assassination, the officer shot at 10th and Crawford in Oak Hill. And there's a witness who says the assailant, a potential assailant of Tippett, fled into what's called the Abundant Life Temple. Do you remember this?
I remember it from your book, yeah. But I don't recall that being an important part of the Tippett. And I've talked to very, like, McBride, established JFK researcher about it.
Yeah, yeah. McBride doesn't mention the Abundant Life Temple in his book. Right. But to Garrison, this was very important. Because he saw a connection between his churches that we've been talking about and the presence of this Abundant Life Temple. Okay. Well, to me, I said, okay, what is this? Because someone saw somebody and whoever it was, there was the jacket that was later identified to be Oswald's found nearby. Was this a safe house? Was this a place for people to, you know, who opened the door for this supposed witness on a Friday afternoon for them to fly to run into this church? It came out of a Pentecostal tradition. And the owner of the building just moved in earlier the year before, and he sold it a year later. So he had it for a very short period of time. But here's where the key is. The pastor who operated out of this church was a former chaplain in the Civil Air Patrol. So I thought that was quite
incredible.
Yeah.
It's like that on so many of these things. There are weird connections. Like Corey Hughes found out that the so-called ice skating rink that Ferry went to the weekend
of the Winterland,
was owned by LBJ.
Oh, you're kidding.
So, that's his cover. All these places are covers. The book depository spooked up to the hilt. So it's just incredible how many, and this is part of that this strange, eerie underground of these old Catholic wandering bishops. It's like the opposite of the formal Roman Catholic Church. It's just like there's all these strange sub rosa connections out there.
It's the perfect cover, really, if you really think about it, because it's so confusing. People have no idea what you're talking about. I'm still having trouble explaining it, you know.
That doesn't leave out, and we have left out the intel purposes. A lot of these alternate ministers had intel and were connected to the FBI through J. Edgar Hoover, right?
Yeah. Oh, well, Bannister. I mean, so yeah, if you you really start kind of peeling back the layers of like an onion when you look at Guy Bannister's outfit, out of which came Jack Martin, out of which came Ferry, out of even, even Oswald was part of that milieu, that kind of anti-Castro, anti-communist front that at the same time, I argue, was really about trying to end the integration process that was happening down in the South. And I think that's a whole aspect of the Kennedy case that I think is completely left out, about how racist and how segregationist the assassins, the conspirators were against the president. I mean, was it driving them completely? Not, probably not. I mean, as you know, there's so many different layers going on here, but it's integral though to preserving the Southern way of life. I mean, this all happened in the South. Okay. And this is only 100 years after the Civil War. And it's just when civil rights is taking off. And JFK makes his civil rights speech on June 11, 63. Medgar Evers of the NAACP is assassinated that night. And things start unraveling very quickly for the president because of civil rights. And those racists and segregationists who opposed the integrations in New Orleans and what was going on in Dallas.
Right.
And so to me,
Brown versus Board of Education.
That's right.
You mentioned that. Yeah,
that's right. That was 1954. And it took almost a decade before it was fully implemented. Eisenhower kind of did it sort of grudgingly. I don't think from a racial standpoint, but I just think he knew. The thing is, I think they knew how much of a powder keg this was, how truly important and how deep race goes in our country. And if that was to come out as being one of the motives, or maybe the motive for the case against for the shooting of the president, then we have a civil war in our hands.
Right. Right.
You know,
it's incredible. So it's just one aspect. So there's a racial aspect. There's the anti-communist aspect and the anti-Catholic sentiment. Right. I mean, even though Ferry's a Catholic, this is the first Catholic. It's perceived as a Catholic president.
Yes. Well, let me say, because that's a very good point, because what also is happening at the very time of JFK's administration, and that is the very important council that happened called Vatican II, which even if non-Catholics might know of, because it had such a change between a kind of, I don't want to say, you know, I don't want to sound, you know, a kind of ghettoized Catholicism that was kind of rooted in one's ethnicity, say the Irish, for instance, or the Italians. And then there's this council that happens that says we're going to kind of be open more to the world, and we want to be more ecumenical with other religions, and we kind of want to open the windows of this church, and we want to change things. And so that's when you had the things went from the Latin Mass to English and the other languages that we now have. And the church has changed completely from a kind of very medieval sort of look to, you know, actually a little more Protestant, the way things looked within the church. And to some, and this is still a huge deal today, to some, this was a great betrayal. This, what are you doing to my church? And Ferry, and not only Ferry, Bannister's mistress, Delphine Roberts, and others in this milieu, like Leander Perez and Jackson Rakow, Leander Perez, by the way, the FBI informant Willie Summers had said he was the financial backer of the JFK assassination. This was a great betrayal. And so not only do you have this big change happening in the church from a kind of conservative theology to a kind of more liberal openness that these people abhorred, but it was connected with the idea of integrating the Catholic schools. And these people actually were excommunicated. Delphine Roberts, Leander Perez, and Jackson Rakow, who are all within Bannister's milieu, were excommunicated by the Archbishop of New Orleans for refusing to for actually making such a big fuss over. And I'll tell you, if you find go on newspapers.com, and Delphine Roberts has all of these op-eds that she wrote to the local newspaper down there in New Orleans. And it shows how much anger and bitterness was directed towards the Kennedy brothers for fomenting or fostering, you know, this integration process. And so she actually, and we know the story is that when the assassination happened in Dallas, she's in Bannister's office. She hears the news and she gets up and dances and applauds and has this great reaction to it.
Right. They're happy. There's a lot of people happy that he's dead. Like they're, and I think you also mentioned in your book, like this was seen as like almost like this world ending event with the Cuban Missile Crisis,
yeah.
Civil rights. So many things were happening, this whole Catholic Protestant tension. So many things were happening. It was like everybody was on edge, right? Like,
I mean, yes.
It's a different environment totally. There's yeah. Delphine Roberts. Yeah. See, I've never even heard her name.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, so right. I wasn't familiar with her. But you know, I would like to point out, if I can. So there is a, people still might be wondering, okay, well, still, I don't understand what the whole point of these fake bishops, what does this have to do with anything kind of thing? I just want to summarize this up for folks, okay. Is that there was a triangle. So as we mentioned, there's people who get these, who become part of these fake orders. Then there's people who, the same people, who then get these fake degrees from fake schools called diploma mills that are unaccredited, that are basically, you know, a person's apartment, like Earl Eagle James operated what he called the National University of Canada outside of his apartment. You know, I mean, they would mail him money and he would send them their diploma. And then the third aspect of this group was the fake chivalric orders. And when you look at in the legitimate Catholic Church, the big order there, of course, back in the Middle Ages were the Templars, but these days you still have what's called the Order of Malta, or right. Knights of Malta.
Okay. Still very influential, very important.
Very influential. Yeah. A lot of kind of elite and who's who. I mean, if you know anybody who is anybody kind of idea, you're gonna be a knight of Malta. Okay. Yeah. Well, there's just like with the old Catholic milieu, there's fake orders of Malta. And this is very important because I know I'm waiting on my FOIA from FBI on this group, because I know they have it. It's even within our circle that we're studying, there is a fake order of Malta called the Sovereign Order of St. John of Jerusalem, SOSJ, or the Shikshini Knights, colloquially known as. And if you look into this, this is what our group of fake bishops were trying to integrate. This, I believe, is the channel that connected the New Orleans cabal with the Dallas cabal, specifically with posturing Oswald as the patsy. They operated under this network, which confused a lot of the mainstream. Because they didn't know if this was, are you talking about the real, like the, I guess they're the Malta, they're the Knights of Malta, you know?
Right, but people just think that's what they are, but they're
yeah, not. Yeah, and I did too. I didn't know, it took a long time to kind of, you're reading these accounts of people, first person accounts who are saying he knew the Knight of Malta, and then they would, I was like, oh man, it's not really the real Grand Master of the Knight of Malta in Rome. It's this fake order. And then it takes a long time to kind of siphon through all of this. But this particular order, SOSJ, Sovereign Order of St. John of Jerusalem, they had a military group that was part of, they were all out of General MacArthur's group of generals. And these are people who are very familiar, researchers would be very familiar with them, like General Charles Willoughby, most prominently, whom MacArthur dubbed "my little fascist." General Pedro del Valle, General Bonner Fellers, William Potter Gale was a colonel, and Colonel Philip Corso. And I thought it was very interesting. I asked the current grandmaster in an email. So this order is still around. I mean, they still have a website. But I asked him about these generals. And I said, was this just more of like an honorary thing to have these, you know, was it just like they sent them a little plaque or something? And then you could say, hey, I sent a plaque to, you know, General Willoughby, and look, he's part of the Order of Malta. Or were they actually involved in the order, you know? And if I can't, this is what he said to me. This is just the other day. He said, MacArthur's staff had active Knights of St. John. MacArthur always hired these types of active intelligence specialists, which I thought was very interesting. You know, he refers to them as other orders, meaning the other orders of St. John, which we're calling them fake orders, but, you know, to them they would be considered genuine. But he says the other orders are engaged in charitable endeavors. We are engaged in a traditional military intelligence mission. I said, what is this guy? What is this guy talking about? But he's sort of saying, yeah, this was an intelligence military operation operating as a completely harmless Kiwanis or Elks Lodge, which nobody would even pay any attention to.
Right.
You know, I just want to say this was the same Shikshini Knights out of Pennsylvania. They were in Pennsylvania at the time in the early 60s. A very bucolic, rustic place. Again, off the radar. Nobody would know about it. This is where their quote-unquote convent was. This was the Order of St. John. This was ultimately the religious group, the umbrella out of which David Ferry, Jack Martin, Bannister, others were part of.
Right. And all connected. Bannister also, I think Bannister was an Order of Jesters. And a 32nd degree Mason. So these guys were all occultists. Even Ferry himself, according to Russo, right, who was played by Kevin Bacon in JFK, the movie, and the real interview that he had with Garrison said that Ferry had black masses. So yeah. It is so bizarre. And the same thing with William Jennings Joseph Bryant, apparently a hardcore occultist, but also one of these alternate old Catholic Church wandering knights. I mean, wandering bishops. It is just so strange. The whole story of this. There's like a strange. And you actually talked to Peter Lavenda, right?
Yes.
Talked a lot of that stuff. Yeah,
I remember. Oh yeah, yeah. I recommend everybody to go find Sinister Forces.
Sinister Forces. Yeah. I mean, he's kind of points out all that high strangeness that was going on with the JFK from the beginning and the end, and also there were all these other groups. I mean, Ferry was, he also was friends with Thornley, right? He became a Discordian. There was that kind of weird phone call where through Inca, right? Wasn't just this whole strange thing where he tried to get Thornley to say that Oswald was the guy who did it?
Well, I'll briefly summarize this. Thornley, Cary Thornley, we're talking about Cary Thornley, who was a Southern California native, and he was in the Marines with Oswald. At the same time. They spent a few months, maybe a short time, at the El Toro base down in Orange County. And that seemingly that was it. Like, I remember. And Thornley, actually, it was Oswald left such an impression on him that he wrote a book about him. He based a fiction story on Oswald even before any of the assassination stuff. It came out in like 62. So, which is a little odd. But actually, as it turned out, nope, Thornley was in New Orleans at the same time that summer leading up to the assassination, probably doing some Bannister work. And specifically after the assassination, there's WDSU TV down in New Orleans. I believe it was WDSU. Thornley goes on. Now, WDSU was the same station from its radio arm that did the debate between when Oswald said he was a Marxist. which comes across as completely scripted. It was part seemingly like he was kind of checking his boxes as making it seem like he was just fulfilling whatever they, whoever wanted him to do what, you know, to do whatever, just check your boxes to make yourself look like a communist, you know, go out there and say you're a Marxist. Well, anyway, so Thornley shows up on WDSU to do an interview on Oswald, that the weekend of the assassination. Okay. Of all people, at the same time, Ferry is doing his strange trip to Houston and Galveston. And there's an error, by the way, William, that I noticed in the FBI report when they're at the, I think they're at the Driftwood Motel. They call up, we have the phone records from their room. He was with two young men. Ferry was with two young men, good accomplice alibis in any case. But he made, there's a phone call that's to, a WDSH. Well, that's according to the FBI report. He called WDSH. Well, there is no WDSH. Most likely, that meant WDSU, which is the, you know, the prominent New Orleans, you know, radio and television station. Why? Well, was he calling to ensure that Kerry Thornley got his time on air to sully Lee Oswald? You know?
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it does.
And I mean, people have alleged that Thornley was one of the guys impersonating Oswald leading up to the assassination. So there are places where Oswald couldn't be, but somebody's right. Clearly acting like, and so that would make sense because Thornley knew Oswald, right? So they bring him in to be the second Oswald and do all that stuff. And I mean, who was it? Corey Hughes flat out said Ferry was on the grassy knoll. Ferry knew how to shoot rifles. He taught Oswald how to shoot a rifle with a scope, right?
Well, yeah. Well, see, here's my problem with that, though, is that we know Ferry was in the New Orleans courthouse on the morning of the assassination.
Gotcha. So there's no way he could have gotten.
Yeah, there was no way. He was. It was Carlos Marcelo's deportation hearing. Ferry worked for the G. Ray Gill, who was the attorney, and he got let out, and he was supposed to. He told, I think it was Delphine Roberts, actually. He told somebody, maybe in Bannister's office, or maybe it was in. He told his somebody, the secretary of some kind, "I'll be right back." But that's when he left. He left New Orleans early afternoon, and then he's on the road that night. Driving 350 miles through a rainstorm to Houston. Thing.
And that was a Friday, right?
The Friday night.
Friday morning or Friday.
Right,
midday.
Right.
Okay, so.
Yeah, 11, Friday. Yeah, 12:30 Central Time. Yeah. So.
It's just so crazy. I was surprised to see Aleister Crowley pop up in your book.
Yeah.
Some of these other characters.
No, because why? Because I really wanted to filter down why there was such an occultic interest between Ferry and a lot of those around him within this milieu of this particular strand of the old Catholic Church. And I thought it was interesting because you drill down enough and you start getting into things like mesmerism and hypnotism. And, you know, you have to start taking seriously this notion of how much hypnotism played a part in the events. And, you know, are we going to quickly dismiss hypnotism as being ridiculous? Well, not when there's MK Ultra out there.
No way. Yeah. No, there's so many strange things. Hypnotism is actually the Rosetta Stone of the post-World War II 20th century. There's absolutely no question about it. But the hypnotism, in this case, there's strange things. Ferry and Shaw drove Oswald to try to get him a job in an MK Ultra hospital somewhere north. Do you remember that?
Well, I think it was East. I think it was the East.
Yeah,
East Louisiana State Hospital or something like that.
Have you ever heard the story of Oswald being hypnotized at Jack Ruby's?
No, not Jack Ruby. It wasn't. No, go ahead. Finish your.
It was at the Carousel Club. He was hypnotized at the Carousel Club, and that's what Martin said. And the first thing Martin said when they were being investigated is that Oswald was hypnotized to do the shooting. That's what he told Garrison. Do you remember that? There's something like that. He said something that he was under hypnotism. If somebody's listening and can find out who hypnotized, it's probably in the Jack Ruby books. Who hypnotized? Because during that time, I just did a show on, it was on another kind of research thing, but this guy Hislop was friends. I mean, it's so strange. Brashears and Hislop were in the same kind of gay newsletter. But Hislop was like a stage hypnotist. And during the 60s and 70s, is much more popular than it is today to do these kind of like traveling hypnotist shows. It was part of like a vaudeville type act. And it, apparently, and I can't confirm this, but Oswald was hypnotized at the Carousel Club that Ruby ran.
It's interesting. Well, now I don't know that story. I didn't realize that that Martin said that. I hesitate. I'll
go back and look at that. No. Go look that up. Let me see if I can.
No, I will. But I will say Ferry, and it's in this book. Ferry suggested that it was not out of the realm of possibility that hit Oswald or someone like Oswald. He doesn't actually say Oswald. He says that was hypnotized to commit the assassination. So you have it coming from Ferry himself that this was a possibility. He quoted like a professor from Johns Hopkins as saying
Rosen, was it Rosen?
He's like, ask him. He's like, I think he'll tell you that he was probably hypnotized. was Ferry giving us a little bit of some Catholic guilt there, you know?
Well, he had a so-called, like you talk about these fake like things. Ferry had some kind of doctorate in hypnotism from some university in Bari, Italy.
Which, ties all into the same milieu of the same fake group of diploma mill folks. It was hypnotherapy, and he went around and said he had a doctorate. He was a psychiatric doctor or a psychologist, which he had neither, you know, none of it. None of it was true.
It is so hot. It's so strange, man. Yeah. Hypnotism is part of it. And him and Brian are both using hypnotism to abuse. Brian got busted for in 69 and probably abused women for decades.
Yeah.
For abusing women. And Ferries was targeting teenage boys. That's what that was his thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I'll quickly say hypnotism looms not only over JFK's assassination, but also RFK and MLK. And quickly, I'll say, well, what about with MLK? Well, James Earl Ray, when he's down in Los Angeles in the months leading up to the April assassination, he's under a fake name and he goes sees a hypnotist in Gardena. Xavier Von Koss. Nothing about Xavier Von Koss at all. Nothing about this guy. Nothing. He happens to show up right at that same time when we need, you know, and he disappears off the face of the earth by the end of 68. I mean, he was right place, right time, you know?
That ties into your title of your book, because Earl Anglin James claims he's the father of James Earl Ray for some reason or other, right?
Very bizarre. Which clearly we know he's not, but I mean, why would you want to make yourself appear ridiculous, you know, unless you were just trying to make yourself seem crazy, you know?
Crazy. You know, and one other thing before I forget, in your book, you quote H. Spencer Lewis. He was friends with Crowley. You could add that into your book of like another Crowley connection.
Is that right?
Because, he knew H. Spencer Lewis's Rosicrucian headquarters were in San Jose. And where was Sirhan Sirhan taking his Rosicrucian classes through? H. Spencer Lewis's Rosicrucian with its adjunct in Los Angeles.
Well, I appreciate
you should listen to my Sirhan Sirhan timeline. It's actually timeline. It was actually written by somebody else, but I read it into the record. And Sirhan Sirhan's all over Rosicrucianism in a big way.
Yeah,
tons of hypnotism
there. You know, that's great. You brought him up, and I will. And he also had. There's also that hypnotistic element to that assassination as well. You know, where he says he basically blacked out. Right, he can't remember.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, they had really. They brought in a pro guy. It was either Diamond from
Berkeley
or some guy.
Diamond,
and said that this guy, somebody's tampered with this guy.
Yeah.
And reputedly, that's the key between JFK and RFK is supposedly William Joseph Bryan, who took credit for it and told two prostitutes when he was in Las Vegas that he was the one who was involved in that.
That's right.
That was his life. That was William Joseph Bryan's life. He was a hypnotist, period. Yeah. He wasn't like a medical doctor who did hypnotist, or he wasn't a psychiatrist like West, who was busy. West was just an incredibly busy guy. He was like head of neuropsychiatry at UCLA. So he's running this whole thing, but also doing stuff on the side. But that's all William Joseph Bryan did.
Yeah. You know, William, I thought it was funny, or not funny, I shouldn't say, a little macabre, but that one of Bryan's pallbearers was Melvin Belli, who represented Ruby.
Do you know who the other one was?
No.
Effie Bailey.
No, you can't.
Effie Bailey. Have you ever heard
that? In the Warren Report.
Yeah, no. These two guys, because William Joseph Bryan was heavily involved in the Boston Strangler and may have actually imputed to the Boston Strangler that he committed all the crimes when he didn't. There's multiple Boston Strangles. It gets so heavy, dude. It's off the charts. Have you ever heard that during the Shaw trial, William Joseph Bryan was sitting in the audience?
No.
Yeah, if you find that, send it to me. If somebody finds that, yeah.
Wow.
There's like little Pete. Yeah, so William Joseph Bryan. And the other thing is he ran the American Institute for Hypnosis. Mm-hmm. There's a connection between him and Ferry in that. That's like we're on like a whole nother time frame. You know, it's incredible.
What do you mean?
It just means that you can prove that hypnosis is involved.
Yeah.
I mean, do you know that there's a connection between, this is according to Herbst, H-E-R-B-S-T, I interviewed him. Yeah, there's a connection between when Oswald was in New York City, he was at a boys' school where they were tinkering around with these boys and was connected to George White, Bureau of Narcotics, George White.
Yeah, George Hunter White.
Yeah.
And I don't know this, but...
Yeah, no, but I'm saying that puts Oswald in the care of these guys for decades, and that Paul Harvey was the guy running the whole fake, you know, head to Russia type people. Like there were multiple people. So there's ties with Oswald to, you know, White, to Harvey, to Ferry, to other, and possibly William Joseph Bryan. That's the whole thing. I mean, it's incredible. The guy was selected for something very early. And they say that in the hypnotist kind of lexicon, you can only, so like if you see these stage hypnotists, they usually ask for 25 volunteers. The reason why is because not everybody's hypnotizable without the use of drugs or torture. So they'll bring 25 people up and see how many get hypnotized. They'll send the other half back, or, you know, 4/5 back, but the other ones are suggestible subjects, right? So back then, even Esther Brooks, I've done a show on him, only like 1 out of 5 at that time, you know, without the use of torture or drugs, can be hypnotized. Suggestibility. They find the people who are this suggestible are people who without fathers, who are independent, needing of approval, all of these characteristics that Oswald fit the bill for, right? His dad died when he was young. He didn't have a father figure. So he's a vulnerable guy for a lot of this stuff, for Ferry, for White, for hypnotism. It's incredible. So that's how sinister these bums are. They're looking for people like that.
And
Sirhan too. His dad wasn't around, right? He's young. These guys are all young. Mark David Chapman. Yep. Chapman is clearly a subject. So it's not just RFK, JFK, MLK. It's John Lennon. It's George Wallace and Bremer, right?
Yeah.
There's some association between them and Sirhan in Santa Ana. You can't write this stuff. It's off the charts.
Right. But like you said, very young, 24, I think.
Yeah, 24. Oswald's 24.
Both staying with Oswald. Yeah.
But I mean, it's also in the context of these very, I mean, Ferry's a very smart guy. He's really a polymath. If you really look at it, he's doing cancer research, hypnotism, flying a plane, is in intel of some sort. I mean, people have flat out said he's a CIA agent, right? So,
yeah, I just haven't seen complete evidence for that. But certainly through Civil Air Patrol and then USAF and whatnot, you know.
Yeah.
And I will say, I mean, that he sort of is often dismissed as a buffoon. But as we said from the top, you know, I went to the same high school. That was one of the it's a Jesuit school. It's one of the hard it's hard.
Right. Jesuits are hard asses. They like it's like if you mess up, man, you get the ruler. Like you get trained.
Especially at that time. He was class of 1935. Yeah.
Yeah. So, no, they don't joke around. You sit in your chair, you don't talk back, you learn, you do your work.
Right.
It's harsh, man. It's tough. I grew up Catholic. I knew what it was like.
Okay. Well, do you think – I think it's interesting, and this hasn't really been discussed really, is that Ferry never really pursued the Jesuit career, even though he was under them as high school and college. He didn't go for the Jesuits. I thought that was interesting.
And that's usually like in the Catholic Church. That's where that's the most militant, the most because there's all these different orders, right?
Right.
But the people who are really intensely Catholic, like – go through the Order of St. Ignatius.
Yeah, the God's Marines.
Yeah, God's Marines.
Their nickname, you know?
Right. Yeah. What are the other orders? Like, you can go for the softer, like,
Well, the Dominicans.
The Franciscans.
Right. The Dominicans.
Yeah, there's a place for you. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a place for everybody.
There's monastic life if you want to just be in a monastery your whole
life.
Right,
Merton, right? You mentioned Merton and the.
Yeah, yeah. Gethsemane, the Trappist. Right? He was a Trappist. Yeah. Trappist,
there you go.
So, you know, they're there. But
it is interesting.
But I will say he wanted to be a diocesan priest in Cleveland. And what does that mean? Well, that means parishes. That means, quite honestly, that means children, unfortunately.
You want to be around kids.
Yeah. You know.
Have you ever read Ferry's, his FBI file and through it when he, like the conversation that he had either with Garrison or like it's an interrogation or something. I think it's from Andrew Scriambo where he's talking to Ferry. Ferry does not sound like he's going to die. He doesn't sound suicidal. He actually is antagonizing the Scriambo guy who comes at the behest of the Garrison investigation from February 28, 1967. People have to read that because it's a direct change or contravention from what's portrayed in the JFK film. It's unbelievable. Ferry is in total control. He's intimidating people. He's saying he's going to get you. Why are you here? He's downplaying Martin. You got to read this interview, man. Have you read that?
Yeah. So just to be certain here, this is where they're kind of staying with him throughout the night, kind of late, right before he dies. Right.
Yeah. He says, Ciambra says, I noticed at this point he was in very good spirits and was laughing and joking and even commented he's feeling pretty good now that he had three cups of coffee already and hadn't thrown up yet. Like, and he was faking being sick, like walking up the stairs.
Yeah.
Like, I got a very different feel. Like he was just lying. He's like, oh, Dean Andrews is a liar. Like, I felt like Ferry's in control. And then the next thing, there's like a Jones Harris thing where they mentioned Tracy Barnes is another freaking CIA asset. It's like,
Well, if you look at Ferry's, the photos from crime scene photos, you know, of his death, they're out there, they're chilling, but they're quite revealing. There's two rifles on a chair with a broom between them. Was he cleaning them? I don't know. But what I really found interesting, I mean, it's not evidence of anything really, but you can fill in the blanks. He has a book that he's halfway through reading that's on the chair. His pants, you know, his dress pants are slung over the chair with his belt still in them and stuff. But there's a book that he's halfway through reading, and the book, you know what the book is?
No.
Inquest. Remember Inquest? By Edward J. Epstein.
Oh, wow. So he's reading about JFK.
Inquest, exactly. Yeah. That was quite telling to me. But, you know, you can't prove anything with that, you know.
One more point about hypnotism in the JFK. Garrison chose to hypnotize Russo so that he could remember everything better and gave him sodium pentothal. So that's part of the case as well.
Yeah, this
hypnotism is all throughout the JFK case, guys.
For better or worse, unfortunately, that didn't really help the Garrison case much when that came out.
Well, do you know the other one is that the so-called guy, I forgot, Slamil, but he said that he had been hypnotized by 60 people in New York City, and that's what discredited him as a as a character witness or something.
Yeah, as a witness. Yeah.
Yeah. No. But I mean, it was kind of basically portrayed in JFK, the film, like, oh, the witness just choked. But it was because he said that he had been hypnotized 60 times.
Wow. I do want to mention, you were mentioning about the Carousel Club and Oswald. But I will say, though, there was the character who was De Morenschild's colleague, George De Morenschild's colleague named Volkmar Schmidt, who at a party in early on, I would look into Volkmar Schmidt as a character because it's not said that he hypnotized Lee Oswald at this party, but he did a kind of like personality thing on him that sounds very much like hypnosis. And that deserves for me. I have not looked into Schmidt since I read this, but I would Volkmar Schmidt. It seems interesting to me from a hypnosis perspective.
Wow, that's amazing! Yeah, hypnotize. There he is. There's something on here where like he like knows Jung, this Volkmar Schmidt guy. I've never heard his name before, but yeah, friends with De Morenschild.
Yeah.
It is so crazy. Your book is really great, man. Congrats for writing it. Because a lot of people overlook this stuff. They don't understand the intel connection to these bishops and all kinds of strange affiliations and things like that. And there's like, you put in your book that writing between, we didn't go over it, but Garrison and Profeta, right? Like literally, I think either Profeta wrote Garrison or Garrison wrote him, right?
They had Profeta. Walter Myron Profeta of one of these kind of fringe churches, was an archbishop in New Jersey, wrote a letter to Garrison. And, you know, we're praying for you, you know, that your investigation is successful. He was super connected to the FBI, and Profeta. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Folks would have to look more into them. We don't have time to go into them now, but yeah.
But interesting. You have some great pictures. You've got pictures of Ferry from St. Ignatius when he had all his hair. Like he's a you know, regular looking guy. Like he gets played off as this hairless.
He's not a bad looking guy. I mean, and by the way, William, I think it bears notice. He graduated a year early. He should have been the class of 36. He graduated in 35. So if in that full picture of the alumni, I had the alumni director of St. Ignatius take that photo.
Oh, wow.
So that's from, but they added him at the bottom, you know, usually you're in alphabetical order. They added him at the bottom. So it seems like he was either accelerated or I think it was that he knew he was going to try to go for the priesthood. So maybe there was like a tie-in, like an extra year or seminary or something like that. You could do in college kind of thing. So he was definitely on his way. At some point that all changed.
Wow. Yeah. It's cool. I mean, I think that Garrison was right. He's really one of the most important figures he was just so multifaceted and he lived literally down the street from Mary Sherman or something. Right.
Like he did. Yeah.
Oxner. And there was a huge MK Ultra testing going on at Tulane, which is down the street but in the same city. There's all kinds of strange things going on.
Cold War espionage at its finest.
He's involved flying around doing all that stuff. Marcello's lawyer,
right, doing quasi paralegal for the head of the New Orleans mob.
It's unbelievable. How does he stay so busy? That's the whole thing. Like he's just always doing something. I mean, it's incredible. There is a documentary on Ferry coming out this year, by the way.
You're kidding.
No, some guy's making it. I forgot what it was, but it's just called David Ferry. And it's deserved. Like the guy, everybody wrote about Jack Ruby, but Ferry and Thornley are both. And I think Corey Hughes made that statement. They're both very, very important.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, be careful what you wish for, because, you know, ultimately, you know, as much as you disagree with the president of the United States, you know, you don't kill the guy in broad daylight. You just and call yourself an American. You don't do it.
It's terrible. They ended up with a total like psychopath in Johnson. Like Johnson escalated the Vietnam War. The Tonkin incident was fake.
Yep.
There were more political assassinations down the road. I mean, people leave out Malcolm X. That was a whole lot of FBI job, 65, right?
You know, and look at what we're still doing. We need it to end. We need it to be put. It needs to come out in order for us as a country to move on, because we haven't moved on. I think I'm broadly speaking for, I don't intend to speak for the entire 8 million people or whatever, but right. I mean, don't you think?
Yeah.
I mean,
they're still covering it up. They're still covering it up, James. They still will not release the files. Right. Oh, we'll release them in 70 years or whatever. There's still files being held back. For what reason?
Yeah.
You know, but other people like you and other people are putting it all together and they're seeing a clearer picture. And they really were threatened by Kennedy for whatever reason, Catholic, racism, anti-communism, Cold War. And I mean, there just were so many crazy people around Kennedy. And I think Ferry was kind of one of them, but like his whole military, the military guys. Lemnitzer and what was the other character? Oh my gosh!
Oh, Curtis LeMay.
The Curtis LeMay.
Can I just address a couple of these questions?
Yeah, please do.
So you know, John B. Ferry was booted from Jesuit order for inappropriate interactions. It wasn't the Jesuit order. It was just the diocesan order, and then it was the diocesan seminary, and then he tried another seminary called the Missionaries of the Precious Blood, I believe it's called, down in southern Ohio, and that also didn't work out. But yeah, no, he wasn't a Jesuit. And then up top, someone was asking about the location of the Abundant Life Temple. That's at 10th and Crawford in Oak Hill. It's not there anymore, but you can find photos of it's in the book. You can find photos of this fantastic looking three story building, huge church that some would say was a refuge for one of the assailants of J.D. Tippett.
Just like the three bums supposedly walked into the Masonic Temple, right? Yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of weird cake. People were there with KKK badges at the killing of Kennedy. I mean, it's super hostile. But that area, Oak Ridge, was really just across the freeway, like where Kennedy got shot. And it's not that far from the site.
Not at all.
Right? Yeah.
Not at all. And the whole Tippett angle, I mean, well, really, real quick, I mean, really, the whole red herring to me, and we didn't even mention his name once, but the whole red herring is Oswald's supposed assassination attempt on General Walker.
And what's your take on that?
That to me says, I just don't buy it. First off, the whole thing feels scripted. Like it's April 10th, 1963. And, you know, the good American General Walker, who, by the way, was disgraced from the army. I mean, he was put in a mental institution by the Kennedy brothers. You know, he was the figurehead of the radical right. He, you know, he hated the idea of what America under the Kennedys was doing and portraying. He's supposedly doing his taxes and he's leaning over working on his taxes when a shot comes through his window. And he grabs his gun and he goes out and it's later comes out only at, so this is April, only after the assassination, almost 8 months later, does it come out through Marina, even before Marina, through a German newspaper, said that assailant against Walker was Lee Oswald.
Right.
And Lee Oswald, so you see, he doesn't know what he's doing. He's just a loony guy because Walker is the head of the radical right, and he's supposed to be a communist who's shooting against the left-leaning president. So he doesn't know what he's doing, was the official story. But it's interesting that it came from a German newspaper, which I think was planted by Walker himself. He was based in Germany for a long time. He has a lot of German connections. He was part of these Schickschinny Knights. He's part of the whole radical right, you know. And some think he is the mastermind behind what happened in Dallas from a radical right perspective, you know.
Wow. And this guy, I mean, Walker, he was eventually, he liked dudes. Like he was on the down low, right? Like he was homosexual.
That's right.
And that's the whole thing is like he's like presenting himself as Mr. Patriot, and he's part of 7 Days of May. I've done a whole show on 7 Days of May.
Oh gosh,
ties into JFK. It's really a component of the JFK assassination. It's a critical component because Kennedy. It shows Kennedy knew what he was up against. He didn't know. I don't know if he knew what was going to end up, but he knew he was contesting with some real heavy players. You know.
Yeah. And I think that's often glazed over as kind of like a Curtis LeMay, well, the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Bay of Pigs didn't go our way, so we're going to go have our revenge against JFK. But again, a lot of these generals that I mentioned under MacArthur who were super right, and by the way, they were Christian identity. They were Christian nationalists. They were people who thought that Jesus wasn't a Jew. They thought that the real 12 tribes, the 10 tribes of Israel came from the north of Europe, that they were white. And this was very important. And why is this still important today? Why is this still something that we haven't put to bed today? Because you have January 6th of 2021, when you have Christian nationalists and Christian identity people storming the Capitol in a de facto insurrection. So this still hasn't been dealt with by us as a nation, because it's still such a huge issue whenever you bring up the idea of race, okay? And it's still, it happened in Dallas in 63, and it's still happening today.
It's crazy, man. It's unbelievable. Where's a great book, great conversation. Thanks for sharing your time. Where's the best place to get the Mad Bishops?
I would go to trineday.com. They're the publisher of the book. Please go there. I actually don't have a website, but if you want to find my follow-up articles, I'm on Medium, James F. Day.
So I'll put a link to your Medium articles. Okay. And is that the best place to reach out to you if people have any further questions or anything? Is through Medium, or do you have social media?
No, I actually don't have social media. Okay.
Medium has contact, doesn't he? Yeah,
Medium has contact, but also trineday.com. I get notices from the publisher sends on to me correspondences. So you can write directly to us.
I'm in touch with you through Trineday. Well.
Okay, yeah. William, can I just quickly say this last question about Mr. Day's thoughts on the Spotlight expose on the Boston Archdiocese? I think it was an applauding moment in journalism and in starting to start what was the domino effect of the 2002 scandals, and we saw how rampant, you know. I mean, look, the priest who baptized me also was removed for infractions against youth, and that only came to light after the Boston expose. So it really started, and Pope Francis has really made it a hallmark of his pontificate. I still think it has almost irrevocably damaged the church, though, but it needed to get out there. So I applaud Spotlight.
Great. And again, the title of the book, full title, is The Mad Bishops: The Hunt for Earl Anglin James and His Assassin Brethren, and the author is James Day. And I'll put a link to your Medium articles and your contact information. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, William.
All right, stay there.